From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open from American Express, presenting the interactive webcast event, Making a Name for Yourself. Kate and Andy Spade and Bobby Brown discuss their leap from business to brand, created by Open from American Express. Registration at openforumonline.com.
This week's edition of Please Explain is going to be not just interesting, we hope, but extremely practical. It's all about cooking, and we have two experts with us to aid us in understanding everything from the difference between searing and braising to the chemistry of a successful souffle. Later, they will be taking your questions. Catherine Alford is the Test Kitchen Director of the Food Network Kitchens and author of a new book called How to Boil Water, Life Beyond Takeout. It's published by Meredith Books. And Shirley Carrier is a chemist and the author of Cookwise, The Hows and Whys of Successful Cooking from Morrow Cookbooks. I'm very pleased to welcome you both to our show. Hello.
Well, it's great to be here.
Catherine, the point of Please Explain is to be able to ask what might otherwise be embarrassingly simple questions. So for all of those out there who may feel at a complete loss in a kitchen, is there a trick to successfully boiling water?
Putting the pot on in enough time, I think, is the biggest issue that people put on. But fill it up with lots of water as well. Usually people don't have enough, whether it's for pasta or vegetables. And a nice heavy pot, put a lid on it, turn it on, and then go do something else and come back to it.
Well, we cover the pot before the water boils, but then we, let's say if it's pasta, we cook the pasta with the cover off. Now, what's the thinking behind that? Wouldn't the pasta cook faster if the pot was covered?
Well, it will, but it also overboils and it goes all over the stove, and you want to be able to get in and stir it around a little bit so that the pasta doesn't clump up. And that's one of the reasons why you want to have enough water so that when you put the pasta in, it doesn't lose the boil.
But why boiling? Why wait until it's actually at this rolling boil? Wouldn't things cook just as well if the water was near boiling?
No.
What happens? Is there some transformative thing that occurs with boiling?
Well, I think that, A, it's temperature, for one, and the way it moves things around in the water. And Shirley is an expert at all the chemistry of boiling versus simmering.
With vegetables, it's really important for the water to be boiling, because you will lose an enormous amount of your vitamins if you put it in and let it warm up slowly. There are enzymes in vegetables that just gobble up your vitamins in a temperature range there. But if you plunge it in the boiling water, that instantly kills these little enzymes so that your vitamin C is saved.
So that's mostly for cooking greens when we're cooking them fast?
Cooking vegetables. See, the big secret of keeping bright green vegetables green is a short cooking time. There are two forms of chlorophyll, beautiful bright green and yucky army drab. Uh-huh. And this is caused by acid. The least little bit of acid somewhere in chlorophyll structure, there's a magnesium in a ring, and chunk, it falls out of the ring. With any acid. Now, the acid is coming out of the green vegetable itself. And the longer, and this, as just mentioned, it's important to have a lot of water because this will dilute the acid coming out of your green vegetables.
What about colors other than green? When we're cooking vegetables or fruits that are red, for example, like red cabbage, red peppers?
Red cabbage. We're just the opposite here. There are three types of red, and the type of red that's in red cabbage, anthocyanins, and these compounds are extremely good for us, like blueberries and the blue reds. They're full of antioxidants. But you can be standing there when you put red cabbage on, and you're totally innocent. You haven't done a thing, and it turns blue. And that's because some of the acids have evaporated off. And this compound needs acids to stay bright red. So all you need to do is add a little lemon juice or vinegar. Or many red cabbage recipes actually will have apples. And that's so that the acid will come out of apples and keep the red cabbage red.
And we understand why that chemistry occurs? I mean, what is it about vinegar that's going to keep it from turning blue?
Well, this compound, if it gets the least bit alkaline, the anthocyanins, they're like litmus paper. They go from red to blue. Maybe you've seen a blue halo around a cherry in a muffin. And this is because the batter of the muffin is alkaline. It has baking soda in it. And if you want to get rid of your blue halo, you just need to switch to baking powder, which is neutral. And then maybe even add a tiny bit of acid to the batter, a little bit of cider vinegar, half a teaspoon.
My guests are Shirley Currier, who is a chemist and author of Cookwise, The Hows and Whys of Successful Cooking from Morrow Cookbooks. Also Catherine Alford, who's a test kitchen director of the Food Network Kitchens, author of How to Boil Water, Life Beyond Takeout, which is published by Meredith Books. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Catherine, what happens when we add other things like salt boiling water?
Well, salt is very important. I come at it from the point of view of taste. If you boil vegetables or pasta or really anything in a lot of water without any salt, it's going to be absolutely bland and just have no flavor to it. And I think it's one of the things people are most afraid of is I've had many people say proudly, oh, I don't cook with any salt. And I'm like, I'm so sorry for you. Because without salt, it's one of the basic flavors and it's really important to use it.
It's just not putting too much salt in.
You can make it really as salty as the sea sometimes. And you know, with vegetables, for example, if you put a lot of salt in in boiling, one of the classic techniques is to boil, take the vegetables out, and then quickly refresh them in a rinse of cold water or even ice water.
But what about people who are on low-sodium diets?
There are other techniques that they can use that are not as focused on using the salt, but I don't really feel like you get that much salt. It's in all that water, remember, all that big boiling water.
Shirley, you wanted to add something?
Yes. Salt is vital as far as taste and flavor goes. The people at Monell Chemical Synthesis Center, Dr. Beecham, gives a wonderful demonstration pointing out that salt it suppresses bitterness. And he'll say, you know how pastry chefs always say, add a pinch of salt to the dessert to bring out the sweetness. And he'll show a diagram with the levels of sweetness and bitterness before salt and then after salt. The sweetness stays about the same, but the bitterness drops way down. And he also will do a dramatic demonstration taking a bottle of grocery store tonic water and giving everybody a sample and say, now identify the bitter quinine and the sugar water syrup that's there to make it palatable. And then he'll take the rest of the bottle and put it in a pitcher and add a little salt and send the sample around. And the tonic water tastes almost like sugar water.
Now, what about adding sugar when you're cooking with boiling water? What does that do?
Well, as Catherine pointed out, sugar is great for flavor, but cooks can use sugar to control the degree of cooking. You see, when you heat a fruit or vegetable, the glue, the pectin substance glue between the cells, changes to water-soluble pectin and dissolves, and so the cells fall apart. Now, sugar or calcium prevent this change from occurring. And now, see, you can see this dramatically, and like the difference between refried beans and Boston baked beans. You can take the same beans and cook them for 6 hours without sugar or anything with calcium, and they're mush. But you can add molasses, which has both sugar and calcium, and brown sugar, and you can cook those beans for days, and they still look like beans.
We invite your calls at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. Catherine, in thinking about cooking in the most basic way possible, can we talk about categories of cooking?
Sure. One of the things to think about is when you're cooking something, is it going to cook the minute you hit the pan or sort of slowly? So if I'm sautéing something, I heat up my pan, very important step that most people don't do. Heat up the pan, put what you're going to put in the pan, and you can hear that sizzle right away. It's sort of like applause as it hits the pan.
Now, what happens if you put it in a cold pan?
If you put it in a cold pan, A, it's more likely to stick because it doesn't have a chance to sear. And it's going to cook unevenly and you won't get as nice of a brown. Whereas, and something that you're going to cook by a sauté should be small because it is going to hit the pan and get the heat right away. Versus something like baking or roasting, which there are differences, but they're essentially the same.
Well, Michael LaMonaco says that if you're cooking a turkey for Thanksgiving, let's say, you should heat up the roasting pan before you put the turkey in it.
Well, then he's going to get a nice, good skin on the bottom of it. And sometimes you'll do that, and that's when you want it to sear. And the wonderful things about cooking is that a lot of times it's a combination of, like, searing, you sauté it, and then you might put your thing in the oven so that it cooks more gently.
Now, Shirley, I assume that the beginnings of cooking was somebody dropped something into the fire and discovered that the cooking worked very nicely. That's... Right, that's
well,
one way, that's direct heat.
A fascinating thing, the group at Harvard, Dr. Richard Wangham, points out that we owe our big brains to cooking. You see, brains...
I was wondering what I got this big brain from.
It
requires 20 to 25% of your daily food energy intake to keep up that brain. Anyhow... Cooking made the roots and tubers of things that our ancestors were eating softer and easier to chew and substantially increased their available food energy. So we're just really indebted to cooking. And now, you know, Catherine, she's a really good chef. And the first thing she said when you talked about hot surface, what happens if you put it in cold, she said sticking. And this is absolutely true. Anything with protein, some liquid protein will get down in any imperfection in the pan. And then when you heat it, you're literally cooking the food into the pan. So that hot surface, heating the pan first, is really, really vital to prevent sticking. Then the food can cook on the surface, not in the surface.
So we have these different ways of cooking, all involving heat. Direct heat, like broiling. Indirect heat, like baking. Wet heat, boiling, or mixing ingredients with water. And are there others?
Well, within like the wet heat category, if you're steaming, you're above the water. And if you're braising, then you're sort of partially submerged in the liquid.
And I've heard you say, Catherine, that air... is one of the ingredients that we... I never thought of air as an ingredient.
It was a revelation when a teacher said that to me. But absolutely, when you think of a souffle and you're whipping the egg whites or anything that has egg whites in it, whether it's a souffle, waffles, you're trapping the air into it, folding it into a batter, and then cooking it and trapping it. So it's never in the ingredient list, but in the method, you may need to make sure that you're getting air into an ingredient. So it is as light as air.
What about eggs, Shirley? They're called for in so many kinds of cooking. Is there something special, transformative about eggs?
Well, eggs are marvelous protein. And just to finish the air, all of baking is very, very dependent upon air and steam out of the doughs and things. A wet dough, I'm famous for my biscuits. They're really my grandmother's biscuits. And the secret of these biscuits is a wet dough because all of that liquid turns to steam in the hot oven. And my biscuits are as light and fluffy as can be. With eggs, eggs are a perfect example of protein chemistry that you can see. See, individual natural proteins, raw proteins, picture them like a little wire ribbon with little bonds holding them together. There's one here, one here, one over there, but they're totally separate individual units. And then when you see, you can see right through your egg white in the frying pan. But when you heat that egg white, pow, those bonds pop open, and your little ribbons are floating around with their bonds sticking out. and they bind together, and there's no longer room for light to go between. And this is when your egg turns solid white in the frying pan. This is when your fish or chicken, you know, raw fish and chicken have that glassy look, but you cook them and they turn solid white. And the big secret of this protein chemistry is cook them just long enough so that these proteins bind but still have moisture trapped. If you continue to cook, those little bonds tighten up and they squeeze out all the moisture and your food becomes dry and overcooked like leather.
Now, Catherine, the yolks are emulsifiers, aren't they? I've been told that if you want, for example, to put cinnamon into something that involves eggs, you should separate the whites from the yolk, and then the cinnamon will mix in perfectly. But if you don't, you get all those little specks. Or if you have melted butter and you want to mix it in with something with eggs, it's best to do it just with the yolk.
Well, the yolk can do amazing things. I mean, the classic sauce we see is a mayonnaise, which is an emulsification of egg yolk and oil. And it's incredibly versatile when you're working in the kitchen. People are a little freaked out by emulsifications. They're very forgiving. If you make a mistake, you can fix it very easily. If you break, you know, that broken sauce with a mayonnaise, you can just add it back into another yolk or other things that are emulsifications, like mustard.
Should eggs always be fresh? I know when you make fried eggs, you really want fresh eggs because the yolk gets real high.
Right.
But are there times when older eggs might be
older
better?
Older eggs are easier to peel, for sure. Older eggs whip better. And the age of the egg, you can pretty much, you know, you don't have to be crazy about it. But if you have super fresh eggs, it will absolutely change the timing of your recipe. They'll cook so much faster. I made a custard once with farm fresh eggs, and it cooked in about half the time. And I realized, oh my God, it's the eggs. They're so fresh.
We have to take a little break. When we come back, we invite listener calls to please explain. There's so much more to talk about cooking. And if you don't ask the questions, I will. But I see some really interesting things coming in here. My guests are Catherine Alford, who is the Test Kitchen Director of the Food Network Kitchens, author of How to Boil Water, Life Beyond Takeout, which is published by Meredith Books. She was one of the chefs at the Quilted Giraffe, one of the great restaurants of America. And Shirley Carrier, Your name is spelled Corrier, so it's hard to pronounce. She's a chemist and author of Cookwise, The Hows and Whys of Successful Cooking. That's from Morrow Cookbooks. Our number again, 212-433-9692. We're back with Please Explain. My guest, Shirley Carrier, whose book, Cookwise, The Hows and Whys of Successful Cooking, is from Morrow Books. Catherine Alford, whose How to Boil Water, Life Beyond Takeout, is published by Meredith Books. And we're taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Harold from Fairlawn, New Jersey, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I've seen that when I crush or chop garlic and leave it in the refrigerator overnight, or even for a couple of days, it gets much, much sharper over that time. Can you explain why that is?
Shirley?
I would imagine that this is the oxidation and that flavors are absolutely going to change upon standing. The one thing you absolutely don't want to do is keep garlic under oil at room temperature, because that allows botulism to grow. So if you have oil on the garlic, you need to keep it no longer than 1 or 2 days refrigerated.
Okay, thank you so much for your call. Dwayne from Manhattan.
Hi, I'm an advocate of steaming vegetables, and I think it's better than boiling because the water turns the color of the vegetable, and it seems that the goodness goes out of it. So my first question is that true, the steaming is superior? And second of all, is there a secret when I steam vegetables to bring out the taste even more? Because I think that it works very well.
Well, steaming, definitely you get less water loss and less of the vitamin loss. One of the keys to successful steaming is, A, once again, that water should be totally boiling, and that you have them in small, you cut them into smaller pieces. If you steam them in very large pieces, they're going to cook unevenly. And once again, I always give a little salt to them even when I'm steaming.
Now, Julie Sani, who is the writes a wonderful Indian cookbook, says that microwaving is like steaming. And she's one of the few people in the business who actually suggests that you microwave, especially for Indian food. She also says that it holds, that microwaving holds in the nutrients.
I love microwaving certain vegetables. I think asparagus done in the microwave is my actually technique of choice, because then I can also do it lightly dressed. There's less cleanup. And it really does capture the essence of the flavor that way.
When you were working at top restaurants like the Quilted Giraffe, did they have a microwave in the kitchen?
It was at the beginning of that technology, and we didn't use it very much. It was used for staff meal.
Alexis from New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hello. Hi. Yeah. Ms. Corr, I'm a big fan of yours. You've got a great book with Cookwise, and I teach cooking in New Jersey. And one of my questions is this. I make lentils often, and, yeah, I experiment with a whole bunch of different types of lentils. And you said something about sugar or the molasses in baked beans, which
yes, a tip allows from Indian cooking, again. They use a little bit of fresh ginger and a spinach leaf or two, And this makes, according to the Indians, women, makes the lentils creamier. And the reason on the fresh ginger contains an enzyme, just like raw pineapple, that attacks, it attacks both collagen and meat protein fiber. So it would definitely make them tenderer.
And if you want, I wrote an article once about lentils and ate nothing but lentils for a month. So I can talk about this.
You're smiling.
I know. Well, my husband has banned them forever from my house. But if you want to keep their texture, you obviously want to buy a type of lentil that has its seed coat still on. If they're the pink lentils, they're going to, no matter what you do, they're going to fall apart. And also salt, once again, really makes a difference. If you cook them in nice, brisk, salted water,
absolutely,
the lentil will hold its shape.
Absolutely, and a little sugar later on in the cooking. Once you get them soft, throw in a bunch of sugar to help preserve the shape.
Thank you for your call, Alexis. Roberta from Chappaqua.
Hi, I love your book too, Shirley, and you make my Thanksgiving perfect because of your brining method, so I thank you. But my question is about oils. Now, I understand that if they get too hot, that they're not so healthy for you, let's say olive oil. And I'm wondering, particularly with olive oil, what would that temperature be? I'm also wondering about nut oils. I have also read that once they're toasted, which I do love toasted nuts, that that's not the best thing for your body. And the last oil question I have is canola oil. Now, I have also read, and some chemistry friends of mine have told me that really, even though it's in almost everything we buy and supposed to be very healthy because it does have good properties, is not healthy for the human body because of its molecular structure. It's just too long for us to process it properly in the same fashion as, say, trans fats.
I absolutely do not believe that about canola oil.
You don't.
Canola oil has 61% monounsaturated fat. That's not quite as much as olive oil, 75. But canola oil has 11% omega-3 fatty acids, which are extremely good for us. And also canola oil has less than the lowest, absolute lowest amount of saturated fat. See, natural oils and fats are a mixture, and they're of anything natural is going to be a mixture of different fats. And olive oil has 14%, and canola oil only has 7% saturated fat.
So when is it preferable to use one rather than the other? Sometimes I see recipes that call for canola oil only, and although I have canola oil, I wonder, well, what would happen if I used olive oil in this recipe?
Well, again, canola oil can withstand higher heat without breakdown. And there are some places that olive oil, although I love it, you know, there's nothing better on a salad. But your chiffon cake, you can't go there with olive oil.
Yeah.
So
it's going to give it a very odd taste.
Right.
Yeah.
So you want a neutral taste in some cases.
Yes. And Cooking Light magazine, they advertised that they had an oil change. And they switched exclusively to canola oil rather than vegetable oil because of its advantages.
I like to have vegetable oil around to clean out the cast iron pan when after it's gotten all gunky. That's the main reason I buy that stuff. But there are times when vegetable oil is fine, too.
Right.
My guests are Shirley Currier, whose book, Cookwise, obviously has a lot of fans out there. It's from Morrow Cookbooks. Also here is Catherine Alford, who's just published a new book with Meredith called How to Boil Water, Life Beyond Takeout. And she is the test kitchen director at the Food Network Kitchens. So she's the one who really knows how to kick it up a notch. And we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Before we go to more calls, Catherine, I had a friend who was a great chef who complained that whenever she went into the kitchen, the first thing she did is she told everybody to turn the flame down, that people in restaurants tend to cook at a very high heat because you can go quicker, but there are times when that really just destroys everything.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the classic restaurant sort of think like a chef idea of high heat, put it out, burn it, get it in and out, just because of the time frame. And one of the joys of home cooking is that you don't have to be on that time frame and the long, slow braises where the water or the stew is gently simmering or that you slowly poach something. You get a whole different taste experience from food that way.
And Shirley, a lot of recipes tell us to rest beef after we have cooked it. Why do we rest the beef? Doesn't it get cold?
Well, what happens, the heat has driven all the moisture to the center. Plus the fact that the center of the meat still may be, you know, not cooked as much as you want it to. And allowing it to stand allows the heat to be conducted to the center so that you get the center, in a more correctly done. Plus the fact that those juices that were shoved to the center now migrate back out towards the surface. And these are actually reabsorbed by the proteins so that it becomes juicier all the way out to the surface. I just want to say a quick word about Cooking 101. I love that book. It starts off really with, what to do with the food when you bring it home, what you should put in the fridge and what you should store at room temperature. It answers a lot of questions that certainly beginning cooks and even experienced cooks have.
Let's go to David from Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Well, well.
Good. Listen, I have a very interesting problem with my pastry. And I've seen it done in Normandy. I've seen it done by friends who do it perfectly. I make a what's called a pâte brisée, which is a pastry jam for tarts. And I use half the butter for sugar for flour, and I mix it all together very, very well. Then I add a little bit of water and bring the whole thing to my to make the ball. I let it sit for a couple of hours. I bring it out of the refrigerator, let it sort of warm up a bit. When I roll it out, it starts to break on me. It breaks up, and if I pick it up, the whole thing breaks apart. I can never put it into my pie tin in one whole piece.
Well, it may just be temperature, and pastry doughs have their own sort of personality, but they're very forgiving once you get them into the tart pan. And I always say if there is a crack, it's going to be covered by the filling, so nobody knows, so it doesn't really matter.
It's only when you cut it. Sometimes if you cut it across the crack, everything falls apart, but that's rarity.
It sounds like it's temperature, that the dough may be just too cold when you're rolling it. And once again, you know, you want it to be sort of malleable and sort of plastic and elastic.
And you may be being a little too careful with the moisture, too. A little wetter dough will hold together a little better for you. You'll have a little more gluten developed, and it will hold together better. So try it a little damper next time.
Thanks for your call, David. Trish from Manhattan. Hi, you're on. Please explain.
Thank you for taking my call. My question's about raw milk. Is it truly more nutritious than regular milk, and is it safe for children, and what if anything gets lost in the process of pasteurization?
Shirley, do you want to answer that?
I would say that raw milk, certainly for a child, is dangerous, and I wouldn't dream of giving a child raw milk. You have to be absolutely certain that it's straight from the cow, and, you know, it's just too risky because so many things can grow on the prime growth medium like milk.
But when you're at a farm, and it's a farm that's supplying milk to everybody, that milk tastes the best you've ever had.
Oh, it's fabulous.
But it's as it picks up bacteria in travel and all the rest that it starts becoming dangerous?
Yes. And in transport from one container to another.
Let's take a call from Lee from Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I have a question about sodium nitrites. I know they're used for curing pork products, and they help keep the color nice and pink in the finished pork, even if it's cooked. And I'm wondering what else sodium nitrite is doing, if it's used for other reasons besides to maintain the color, if there's things that that salt does that ordinary table salt can't do.
Shirley?
I honestly don't know other uses. It is perfectly safe, and corned beef and certain things that really owe their color and to sodium nitrite, but I can't off the cuff think of other uses.
As a preservative is the only way that I can think of it.
Yeah.
Now, Catherine, I've been told that when it comes to cooking, you can play around as much as you want, but when it comes to baking, then you really should follow the recipe. Why is that?
Well, baking really is formulas, you know, whether it's the baking soda and the relationship that it has. And you do have some play, like, for example, the pâte brisée we were talking around. You can play around with the amount of butter or sugar. But in muffins or in anything with leaveners, there is this relationship that you want to respect in the recipe, a good recipe, I will say.
You want to add anything to that? Because I know, Shirley, you say that cooking is one big chemistry experiment.
Well, Catherine and I both agree wholeheartedly on this leavening situation. We talked about it the other day. And one of the biggest problems in baking are over-leavened recipes. Many fine cookbooks have recipes that are over-leavened. And now if you've got too much baking powder, too much baking soda, the bubbles get big, big, big. They get huge, and they float the top and pop. And there goes your leavening. So if a product has too much leavening, it can sink or actually just be a total disaster.
I have to leave it there, unfortunately. Shirley Currier, who is a chemist and author of Cookwise, The Hows and Whys of Successful Cooking from Morrow Cookbooks. Catherine Alford, who is the test kitchen director of the Food Network Kitchens and the author of How to Boil Water, Life Beyond Takeout from Meredith Books. Thank you both so much. Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.